You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin has announced its Teachers of the Year, and for the first time, someone from one of the state's First Nations received the award. We'll talk with him about his work to keep Menominee arts and language alive. But first, if you grew up long enough ago, this theme song will sound familiar. It's the Jetsons. That whooshing, trilling sound you heard is the family of the future traveling in their flying car. Their car isn't unique, it's commonplace in their world. Beyond the Jetsons, many TV shows and films have had fabulous visions of the future. But a lot of the technology they promised, like warp speed, flying cars, or time machines, never really came to be. So what happened? Where are our jetpacks? Our next guest recently took a look at some of the technology we wanted but never got and why many of these inventions are still, maybe, light years away. Bill Andrews is a senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. He wrote the cover story for their June issue titled Whatever Happened to the Future. Bill, welcome to the welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much. It's good to be back.
What made you want to take a look at this technology that still hasn't quite come to pass?
I guess the time was right. I guess that's the joke answer. Really, it's an idea that I always kind of toy with in my head, just in my daily life. When I'm outside and it rains on me, I just think to myself, really? Rain? It's still going to rain on me? It's 2018. What's happening here? Or when I'm appreciating cool technology, I pick up my smartphone to answer a bar bet or whatever, and instantly we have the answer at our fingertips. I think, that's cool. We got that one. We figured that one out. Why can't we figure out some of these other kind of emblematic ideas of the future, like you said, flying cars or time machines or some of these other ideas?
Let's start.
So, yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so we just figured, well, let's take a look and see, are we close to figuring those out? Do we have any more surprises in store with us for any of those, or how are we doing?
Now, you broke down a few different ones, and you looked at, you know, where some of these ideas appeared and where we are on them. Let's start with jetpacks. Now, these were big, right, for a long time in our popular science fiction.
Oh, sure. I mean, the quintessential idea for me is still The Rocketeer, the movie that was some semi-beloved, perhaps. I liked it, based on the comic books before that. And the Jetsons also had their own jetpacks. The Jetsons kind of showed up a lot in this story, as it turned out. They really played a formative role in what we think of as the future, I think. But, jetpacks are one of those things that you think, well, in the future, everything's going to be better, cooler, faster. I got to be able to get around somehow, and things will be crowded. Cars are polluting. They take up a lot of space, a lot of energy. Why not just zip around in my jetpack? It seems so easy.
And there are, in existence, things that we could look at and say, yeah, that's a jetpack, right?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of start out with the lame examples. I mean, astronauts are using a type of jetpack right now. They've been doing it for decades in space to get around in the zero-G, you know, environment that they have. And over water, we have kind of hydro jetpacks that use water instead of gas as their propellant. So you can kind of do these cool loop-de-loops and swirls and fly around over the surface of the water. But that's still not really the jetpacks that we think of that can go over land, that can take you wherever you want to go. And even though there have been some prototypes over the years that have worked temporarily for individuals, to jet around, there was a company that went around the Statue of Liberty famously as a kind of a PR stunt. It's not like any of those have gotten really widespread commercial success. You can't go out to Walmart and buy yourself a jetpack, sadly.
And you are right that there's a Flyboard Air jetpack for your feet. I guess you wear it on your feet, kind of like Iron Man. They aren't selling it yet is one drawback, and they're offering you a 10-minute flight on it. It would cost $250,000. So I see some downsides there.
Yeah, exactly. Not really the kind of thing you have in mind when you picture the future. Everybody gets to fly it. I use this quote in the story, but William Gibson, the famous sci-fi novelist, has said, the future is already here. It's just not very evenly distributed. So if you're super rich and you have 10 minutes to spare, yeah, you could kind of fly around on something like a jetpack, but Maybe not what you have in mind.
Talking to Bill Andrews from Discover Magazine about the technology of the future that still hasn't made it today, stuff that's been in pop culture for years and years. Similar kind of issue here, the flying car. We've been thinking about this one for a long time. And maybe the problem with the flying car and the jetpack, the engineering isn't as easy as it seems like it should be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's the whole thing. There's a reason why cars look like cars and planes look like planes, right? Because it's the most efficient design for that task. And whether it's a jetpack and how dangerous it would actually be to suddenly give some random guy off the street the power of flight, you know, would he make planes crash? Would he interrupt migrating birds? Who knows, right? And with cars, is it going to be as simple as, oh, let's just stick wings on a car and it'll take off? And, well, does that driver then need to have a FAA license? Do we need to figure out the gas mileage equivalent for the planes? Is it going to be super expensive? How does it really work? And while there are some examples, like we talked about the jetpacks, there's some kinds of working prototypes with flying cars too. So it's not like these are impossible. It isn't really as practical as you'd think. It's not as cool as, you know, the stories, the movies and books and everything make it out to be.
Yeah, maybe I'm too practical. I'm coming off a weekend where in the span of about 5 minutes, I saw two drivers cause a traffic jam in a store parking lot. And then I had to honk at someone who was coming over to my lane because they were looking at their cell phone and texting, mm-hmm. like touching stuff on it while driving. Do I want these same people flying vehicles filled with fuel, say, over my house?
Yeah, in three dimensions. It's tough enough to get around. And just think also people getting lost. It's easy enough to get lost on a 2D space, on the surface. Imagine the chaos if we opened up the skies to everybody.
And I want to move on to another one now. And this, the problem is maybe even more the boundaries of science. We've been writing about time travel for a long time. I know H.G. Wells and the Time Machine, there are probably ones before that. It's a staple of science fiction, books, movies, TV shows. As far as I know, we don't have time travel yet, right? Or maybe we do. We just haven't traveled. I don't know. But we don't have time machines. What are the stumbling blocks we're running into there?
Yeah, there, unfortunately, it isn't just a matter of finding the right engineering designs, finding something that works well enough to work. It's really something fundamentally just our universe doesn't seem to allow it. I mean, it seems like it should. It seems as if you can get in a car and travel a big distance in space. Why can't you get in some kind of vehicle and travel a distance in time? But unfortunately, that is just the way that our universe is built in a way. It's not like we can it's not like we have the means of doing anything like that. And even though some of the different sciences can, like the equations work backwards and forwards in time and a lot of physics and math and everything, that doesn't actually make it possible. So a lot of pop physics writers enjoy some celebrity talking about, oh, yes, how time travel would work if it were. That's great, but it doesn't actually mean anything for people, unfortunately. More's the pity.
Let's go to a caller at 800-642-1234. Vern is with us in Stanley. Vern, hi.
Oh, hi. Am I actually on the air?
You are on the air. What did you want to bring up, Vern?
Okay, I got a quick comment. For one, time does not exist. Two, you would have to use more energy than is available because as you go faster and faster, according to Einstein, you gain mass. So it would take an infinite amount of energy to drive a penny faster than the speed of light. We don't have an infinite amount of energy. But like I said, time does not exist. It's a convention. It's a sine wave.
Vern, thanks so much for the call. I'm actually reading a book about time right now, Bill, and there is that debate, the idea that, yeah, time is just this subjective thing we perceive. Mm-hmm. We don't need to get into that right now. But, yeah, that was the speed limit you were talking about. Vern says, hey, do the math. We don't have enough energy in the universe to break the light barrier.
Yeah, it's a pretty hard and fast rule. Einstein famously set down C, as scientists call the speed of light, as the kind of cosmic speed limit. And, yeah, according to Einsteinian physics, relativity, which, as far as we know, is correct, it would take an infinite amount of energy to accelerate anything past the speed of light. Of course, that isn't to say it's completely impossible. Warp speed is one of those ideas that I think at least we can't say for sure it's totally impossible. I do feel a little negative about time travel. Unfortunately, it does seem like that would be impossible, but there might still maybe be kind of shortcuts and workarounds to Einstein's theories that might make something like warp speed possible.
We'll get into warp speed more in just a bit, but briefly, Bill, do you have a favorite pop culture version of time travel?
I mean, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure was pretty great. I'm not going to lie. And not just because I'm a namesake of it, I guess. I don't think that was part of the decision in naming me. But it seemed so easy. You walk into a phone booth and you press a number and then you just zip and there you are in that time period. That seems great. And you could go back and talk with Socrates and Froude and all the other cats. But I don't know. That was a lot of fun. Not super realistic, but fun.
Talking to Bill Andrews from Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha, talking about the fantastic technology from pop culture, flying cars, time machines that still haven't happened. Maybe will never happen. You can join Bill and Rob's Excellent Adventure by calling 800-642-1234. Was there a future technology you were looking forward to that never happened? Maybe something from, I don't know, a cartoon, TV show, book that you read when you were a kid, and you're like, where is it? Where is that now? Food pills from the Jetsons? I don't know. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll be back maybe taking your calls coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the technology of the future that still hasn't happened. Things like flying cars, warp speed, and jetpacks. Bill Andrews is with us, senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. He wrote Discover's piece, Whatever Happened to the Future? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Is there a technology you wish we had access to today? Something out of pop culture that you sometimes ask yourself, why don't we have that? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go back to our callers. Dave is with us in Winneconne. Dave, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call here. I want to know how we're doing on teleportation. I'm so sick of driving everywhere. I just want to be there. Now, such a waste of time.
I think that sometimes, too, you know, you're in that long road trip or something. Can't we just press the button and get there? Bill, that teleportation has been a pretty big one. Maybe not as all over the place as flying cars and pop culture. But Star Trek, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Star Trek, The Fly, notably, didn't turn out so well for us.
I don't want that
there.
Version.
Right. That isn't what anyone wants, I think. But, yeah, I mean, teleportation is a really interesting one because in quantum mechanics, which is the science of the really tiny stuff, particles of electrons and quarks and everything, it is actually possible to quantum teleport things, make matter disappear at one end and appear at the other end. And this is still very, very minute particles we're talking about. It probably isn't really going to scale up. We won't be able to teleport, you know, cars or ourselves around, but it's neat to think about. That's another one that I don't think we can shut the door on completely because the basics are there for individual little tiny things, and even though it's insanely more difficult to do it for big collections of matter like us, it's you can't say necessarily it's totally impossible. That's how I feel about that one right now.
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. And Bill, even if you could do it at something as large as a human scale, I would be a little worried about the whole fly issue or just, hey, we're really complicated things and you're telling me nothing is going to get shuffled around in the transition?
Yeah, there's so much room for error. I mean, I wouldn't want to go first. Let's put it that way.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We touched on a warp speed, Bill, and you said there are ideas that might allow for faster-than-light travel. It would take some funky physics, though, right?
Yes, definitely. Also the name of my high school band, by the way, Funky Physics.
Really?
But I was a nerdy kid, of course. Yeah, I mean, so in the story I mentioned, this Mexican physicist named Miguel Alcubierre, who is kind of the go. Everyone who looks into warp speed in real life will probably recognize that name, because he came up with a way to, like I mentioned earlier, kind of get around Einstein's rules and that absolute speed limit of the speed of light. And so Alcubierre's rules, his suggestions here is that if you are able to put kind of a bubble around the spaceship that you want to travel, a bubble of space-time itself, then you could manipulate that bubble to go faster than the speed of light, and it would be fine because you're not accelerating anything past that universal speed limit. It would be the part of the universe itself. And weirdly, that's okay. So that's a case where the equations work out. It seems like theoretically it should be possible, but to make it actually possible, you'd need all kinds of impossible technology. You need to figure out how to create something with negative mass, which is impossible. As far as we know, that doesn't actually really make sense. But if you could, then Miguel Alcubierre has it all figured out.
And then one more item you look at that this seems like the one we're closest to, having a virtual self or avatar that is exactly the way we'd want to be seen. So first of all, give us the pop culture parallels.
Oh, sure. I mean, if anyone has seen the recent movie Ready Player One, or if you've seen The Matrix, I mean, these are movies that incorporate avatars in centrally into their plot. And the idea just being that the real you, the physical version of your actual body, is one thing, but you can have this avatar, which is a version of you that can look however you want. Maybe it speaks a different way. Maybe it doesn't have an accent if you do. This avatar can be everything that you want it to be, and then that could be how the world sees you. No one would need to see if you have, you know, if you were a few pounds overweight or you have the haircut that you don't like. That wouldn't matter. If you've got these avatar technologies advanced enough, then the whole world would only interact with you the way you wanted it to.
And we have
kind of a nice idea.
We have hints of this. I mean, if you play an online game or if you are still out on Second Life or something, you're sitting there looking at a computer screen, but you've got an avatar that other people see on their screens. That's not quite the same thing, though.
Right, but that's the start. I mean, that's where the term avatar originally came from, the novel Snow Crash, where it started out in this culture in Snow Crash as the same thing, as people in their version of the internet had these avatar versions of themselves, and that's how everyone interacted. And even though in real life right now, it's not like you can tell people, your next-door neighbor, for example, yes, I'm really a snow elf, and my hair is blue, and you should address me as Thangnor the Wicked. That wouldn't really go over so well, but increasingly as these digital spaces become more real. You mentioned Second Life, World of Warcraft, the online RPG video game that is increasingly social. You know, in these digital spaces where people are already gathering, the avatar is already a totally, fully functioning idea. You only hang out with your digital friends the way that you want to with your avatar. And even if it's something as simple as the little picture next to your comment on a newspaper's, you know, comments section, that little picture is a form of an avatar too, because that's how the world sees you. And even though it's a smaller version of this idea of the full 3D hologram of you that others could react with and hang out with, it's still the same basic premise.
Talking to Bill Andrews from Discover Magazine about the technology of the future that never quite came along. Back to your calls. Dan is with us in Madison. Dan, hi.
Hey, guys, thanks for taking my call, and I'm going to have to dumb it up a little bit, but as soon as you mentioned pop culture, iconic stuff, I was thinking about the hoverboard in Back to the Future 2.
The hoverboard from Back to the Future 2. Dan, thanks for the call. Now, people have had these weird, funky boards, but they're not the hoverboard from Back to the Future 2, Bill.
Yeah, I mean, that is such an iconic idea. We talked about including that in this story, me and some of the other editors, but we thought since there's a recent product called the hoverboard, which does not hover, by the way,
right,
and apparently explodes kind of easily, and it has all of its own issues, we figured we'd just stay away from that, stick to some of the other tried and true ideas. But man, that movie made it look so great, this hoverboard, perfect balance. You could go over land, over rough terrain. Apparently, if you had power, you could go over water. It looks so much fun and so easy, and it saved Marty McFly's life a few times. Yeah, I agree, man. I wish we had real hoverboards.
We heard from a few people on Facebook. Tim writes, the technology he wishes we had was a time machine, hands down. Brandy says, flying pods, then we could have vertical lanes of traffic, cut down on traffic jams. Wayne says Star Trek transporter, so he doesn't have to deal with airline hassles. Bill, in our last few minutes, what is there one you would really be all over, you really wish that existed, and you would totally try it out?
Oh, those are very different questions. As much as I would love teleportation, I like I said, I don't think I would be the first to try it out.
True.
But if we did figure out warp speed, some way to travel faster than the light, I think that would be the most exciting to me. As a fan of sci-fi and space travel, knowing that we're limited to just kind of our nearest, not even stellar neighbors, just the nearest planets in a human lifetime, has always been a bit of a bummer to me. So I would love to see what lies beyond, see people travel out into the great beyond of the universe.
And Bill, I have a running, not even quite debate, with your colleague, Gemma Tarlak from Discover, regular guest on this show. She's super interested in, as she says on her blog, dead things, you know, mysteries from thousands or tens of thousands, millions of years ago. And I say, wouldn't it be great to have a time machine to go back and look and see what actually happened? She would rather, you know, use the archaeology and paleontology and use what we got now to try to figure out the mystery. Do you have a side on that fight?
I do not want to get on Gemma's bad side. I'll say that for sure. If I had a time machine, I would go into the future, straight up, and find out what the next video game systems are and how well we've cured all the diseases, and hopefully make sure that we're still around also while we're at it. That's what I would do with a time machine. You guys can debate the past.
All right.
And I'll stay on this side of Gemma.
You'll stay out of that debate. Bill, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I've had fun, too.
That's Bill Andrews, senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. He joined us today to talk about his article, Whatever Happened to the Future. He took a look at some of the technology that we all expected or hoped to have but didn't get, or at least not yet. You can still weigh in, by the way, with the technology you wish we had over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. First, traditional beadwork, pottery, weaving, and other types of art are a big part of the Menominee culture, but keeping those traditions alive takes some effort. Our next guest is a teacher in Kashina who's passing along Menominee arts and language, and he was recently named one of Wisconsin's 5 Teachers of the Year. Benjamin Greenone is a traditional arts teacher at Menominee Indian High School, and he's the first Teacher of the Year from one of the state's First Nations. Ben, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into your classroom, I want to hear how you felt when you found out you were named one of the state's 5 Teachers of the Year.
It was pretty amazing. It made me really nervous because they they had a great big, gathering in our school, and we had our drummers and dancers come out and did an honor song, and my family came out. When I got up on stage, I didn't know they were coming. And it was pretty amazing.
That's great. And a big focus of your teaching is traditional Menominee art. So what kind of things does that include for the students to do?
Well, let's see. Today, actually, we were out behind the school digging a pit for our traditional pottery class. We're going to do a pit firing for their final project for the last project of the year. So we do pottery, I do beadwork. I do a class called Wood, Stone, and Bone, which is experimental archaeology. We look at Menominee artifacts and see if we can figure out how they were created. I do a indigenous film class, looking at how indigenous people have been represented in film since the silent era up till now. And I'm also working on a traditional weaving and basketry class for next year.
A lot of what you're doing, not so much the film, I guess, but a lot of it is taking these Menominee traditions, keeping them alive, passing them on to a new generation. Why was that important to you as a teacher?
Because nobody's doing it. And a lot of these arts that I'm working with the kids are dying arts. And so we have the language around everything that I'm doing in my class. Our traditional language describes pretty much everything that I can do with my kids in the classroom. So it's really easy to incorporate our language and our culture into the arts.
And as I understand it, in a lot of ways, you are going back and learning how to do these things yourself. How do you track down maybe a technique, say, that nobody was there to pass down to you?
Well, you know, I look for other people that are – it's kind of a cultural renaissance going on right now. There's people all around the Great Lakes, Native people that are reviving a lot of these arts. I go to a traditional gathering every year up in Drummond Island of Great Lakes traditional artists. And so I get to interact and do art with them and talk about being teachers in the classroom.
And so much of what you're talking about is learning by doing for the students. How do they react when you bring in the beadwork or head out, like you said, behind the school and fire up that that pit you dug?
Oh, it's interesting. You know, every day is kind of a challenge for me. Some of the students, they're visual learners, and some of them need to be out and playing games and doing stuff. So I try and have a little bit of everything going on so that they can participate in what they feel comfortable participating in. So it's a lot of organized chaos, but it works.
And you mentioned the Menominee language, and you incorporate that as much as you can into the classroom. How does that end up working out for you?
It works out really well. Most of the things that we do every day, if somebody asks me for a needle, they say "Mesna Saponikun," which means "Give me a needle." And you know, we have things for "Pass me the scissors," or "Can I go to the bathroom?" Even, you know, "Nakato Shim Wake Yamesa." You know, they tell me that every time they need to go. So it's really easy if we use things that we do every single day that they can use and feel comfortable with, you know, actually doing that right in the class.
Talking to Benjamin Greenone, traditional arts teacher at Menominee Indian High School, one of our teachers of the year here in Wisconsin this year. I understand you spend a lot of time, Benjamin, outside of the classroom, trying to keep the Menominee culture alive and flourishing as well. What kind of things do you do extracurricular?
Well, I'm on the Menominee Language and Culture Commission. I'm the vice chair. It's my third year, I believe, on the commission. And we work on getting our language teachers certified. We also, anything that, that has to do with language or culture that comes into the tribe, we kind of oversee. I am a volunteer organizer at the Mawachesnia Language, Culture, and Arts Center here on the reservation. They set aside about 3 acres and a building for us right on the lake to practice our traditional arts. We do wild ricing in the fall. We do maple sugaring in the spring. We have traditional gardens there in the summertime, and we do some storytelling and stuff in the winter. And we also have family camps and our culture camps that come through. I'm also a culture camp counselor. We spend 2 weeks out in the middle of nowhere in our forest on one of our traditional village sites, working with youth ages 12 to 17.
When I think of traditional cultures, you know, there are cultures and traditions, but every artist puts their own spin on them too. Do you see your students taking the pottery or the beadwork that you teach them and taking it in new directions?
Oh, absolutely, all the time. I try not to limit them on using our traditional designs. Anything that gets them excited about doing beadwork or pottery or weaving a basket and letting them kind of explore that, that's the most important thing to me is getting them excited to do something like that. And as they start to build their skill, then I, you know, start showing them how our ancestors did it, and they get kind of excited about that and want to use their newfound skills to create some of the objects that our ancestors have created for thousands of years.
Do you feel like the students are having that connection with the traditions and the history that kind of gradually dawns on them through the class?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we have a really close-knit community, and our culture and our traditions are very much embedded in it, pretty much everything that we do. So being able to express themselves through art and through our culture and through language, I think is something that gives them a unique feeling, a feeling of connection to our community.
You mentioned the idea of a renaissance going on, and I've talked to guests on the show who say American culture at large tends to look at Native American culture as something in the past. You know, this is in the 19th century or before. Is it a part of your goal to make sure that people know this is something that's alive, that's happening in 2018?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. You know, I have one student that's beating a notorious big medallion. I've got students doing different kinds of pottery that's not not traditional, I would say, but runs in the traditional vein. So they're kind of branching out and really getting their own voice as what it means to be a Menominee artist living in 2018.
And speaking of branching out, do you have ideas in your head like, oh, I'd love to add this either to the curriculum or as an extracurricular? Is there something you're looking to do next?
I'd like to do some more building outside. I think that getting my kids outside of the classroom and actually working out in our forest, where our school is kind of surrounded by forest, and it's an easy walk to get there and be immersed in a whole different environment. Getting them to understand what what plants are useful for dyes and what kind of fungus we can possibly eat or use, and traditionally. And like doing more plant identification and just, I guess, really getting outside and doing more things like that.
Well, I want to take your class now, Benjamin. Thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Ben Greenone is a traditional arts teacher at Menominee High School in Kashina, one of the state's 5 Teachers of the Year. He was with us to talk about his work to keep Menominee arts and language alive with his students. Now, a new report from the New York Times says Facebook's privacy issues may go further than originally thought. In a story out yesterday, the company was found to be sharing user data with at least 60 device makers. Think companies like Apple and Samsung that make cell phones and tablets and other devices. The news comes as the company continues to face scrutiny over privacy concerns and its role in the 2016 presidential election. Cheyenne Guha is an assistant professor of computer science and director of data science at Marquette University. He's done research into data privacy. He joins us now with the latest on this story. Cheyenne, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks a lot. Appreciate you having me here.
And Cheyenne, we've heard a lot about Facebook giving its data to app makers. That's been a lot of the big concerns here. This looks a little different. It's the companies making the technology. Talk about how widespread this would be.
This is really widespread. I mean, we have to understand that Facebook is, in general, not doing these types of data sharing because of some perceived malicious issue. There are absolute positive benefits that regular people like us who use devices and social media that we derive from these particular relationships. In general, data sharing is used to make app experiences and app development better. So it is a positive thing. On the other hand, people generally do have some expectation of privacy whenever they're sharing their data online or through some app or through a particular device. But very few of us actually read the user agreement. So all of this is not very surprising. In the academic community, we've known that such practices exist because they're kind of clearly spelled out in user agreements and in the walls of text that we usually click yes before we start using some device. But whenever a new story like this breaks, it's always some reason to kind of pause and reflect and think whether we should be, we should have some more stronger expectations of privacy than what we have right now.
Yeah, talk some more about the benefits, because Facebook has said we view these companies as partners. They're hosting, in effect, our Facebook app. We want them to know how our customers are experiencing this so they can make it as good an experience as possible. So why, if I'm the technology designer, if I'm the Samsung or Apple trying to make my phones, why do I want my consumers' data to help me in my decision-making?
Oh, absolutely. There are many good reasons. I'll give you a very simple reason. So a lot of us use, for instance, Android devices, and if we use Android devices, then we often use Google Maps or some other. If we were using Apple iPhone, then we often use Apple Maps. So this you know, this is a very positive use of technology for us. But what if using Facebook data, using data about our friends and other relationships and other events that we're interested in that are all available on Facebook, we can provide a better way or better navigation or better location services, right? So this is one aspect of data sharing with devices that are very popularly used all over. And something that most people use on a regular day-to-day basis if you indeed do use your you know, Google Maps or Apple Maps or what have you. So this is just one example, but there are many other use cases out there, some more technical, some not.
Let's talk about the possible downside. As I understand it, when the, say, Samsung or Apple gets my data, they also are accessing my friend's data, my friend's friend's data, even regardless of their privacy choices. And there's just a worry. Do they know too much? Is their use of my data secure? Could somebody else get access to? What worries might there be?
Absolutely. So in general, when we think about privacy, we often think about individual privacy. We often think about privacy in terms of access control and authorization and authentication. However, we've been in the academic community, we've been talking more about the social and network dimensions of privacy. So it may not be directly related to us. So, for instance, I don't have to know exact details about you. But if I know enough about your friends and your other network connections, that I might get just by convincing them to sign up for some app on Facebook or by virtue of the fact that they use similar devices to us, then I automatically know more things about you. And that, in general, is a violation of a reasonable expectation of privacy. So algorithms today that are used to provide valuable services that we just talked about can also be used for malicious purposes. Now, the burden of proof here obviously depends on the fact that, well, let's hope that these device manufacturers are not going to do anything untoward with our data. But the broader question that we as a society have to figure out is, should we want to live in this type of a model? Because this is the prevalent model via which tech companies exist and operate nowadays. The question is, should we?
Briefly, we just have a few moments left. Are these issues we're going to be wrestling with for years to come?
I definitely think that these are issues that we are going to have to figure out. So, for instance, the European Union recently passed the GDPR framework that provides a regulatory regime for in the ways that data can be shared or not shared, and for the first time actually spells out fines and other punitive measures should tech companies not deal with the data in the ways that they have promised.
And we'll have to leave it there. We'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Cheyenne Guha, Assistant Professor of Computer Science and Director of Data Sciences at Marquette University, talking to us about news that Facebook has been giving device makers access to user data. For the next 2 weeks, WPR is profiling candidates in the 2018 governor's race. Today, Laurel White has this profile of state school superintendent Tony Evers, the man who says his statewide name recognition means he's the only Democrat who can beat Governor Scott Walker.
Even though he hasn't been a classroom teacher for years, Tony Evers has the sort of personality that you could see coming in handy in a room full of elementary school kids. He's calm and quiet and polite. Some Democrats might say a little too polite for politics. When you ask him about one of the biggest political issues of the day, Foxconn, he makes it clear he thinks it was a bad deal for Wisconsin, but he's kind of nice about it.
It's not that I want to be a jerk about this, but the fact of the matter is we do have needs in this state, and some of those needs can be made by making Foxconn a good corporate citizen.
It's that type of answer that has some Democrats questioning whether Evers is tough enough to beat Governor Scott Walker. Liberal radio host Mike Crute, who had a short-lived run for governor himself, said on his show last month that Evers didn't have what it takes to be considered the Democratic frontrunner.
I'm not saying it's entirely Tony's fault. I mean, the man's got thin skin. He can't take it. He's a bad debater.
Crute said Evers would be, quote, horrible on the stage next to Scott Walker. Jeff Mayers is the president of WisPolitics.com, a news service for political insiders. He acknowledges Evers is not what some Democrats in Wisconsin are looking for right now.
I mean, I think that a lot of Democrats, rank-and-file Democrats, are looking for the passionate leader, the who will go out there and, you know, cut up the Republicans and, you know, lead them to, you know, resurgence.
But Evers says being a loud, tough, aggressive candidate isn't what's going to win this race for Democrats.
Shouting does not translate into leadership.
And he isn't apologizing for who he is.
I am who I am. I mean, honest to God, I've been doing this for a long time.
Tony Evers is where he is today, running for governor, in part because of his quiet, steady personality. He has years of experience as a successful behind-the-scenes administrator for Wisconsin schools. He's an education policy expert. And he says his years of experience with schools have prepared him to govern the whole state. At the root of his argument is how education touches so many things.
People recognize the importance of education for economic development, for our democracy, for having good health systems, for having a well-trained workforce. All those things begin at the in our K-12 system and our University of Wisconsin system, tech college system.
Early supporters urged Evers to run for governor in part because Wisconsin voters liked him enough to elect him three times as state school superintendent. Wisconsin's last Democratic governor, Jim Doyle, won three terms as the state attorney general before he made the jump. Evers talks about the power of his name recognition and his record of winning elections a lot in his campaign. He says he brings to the table one very big thing Wisconsin Democrats are looking for in 2018.
They're looking for somebody that can beat Scott Walker, for starters.
Evers does push the name recognition argument a lot, but he also says, at the end of the day, people cast their ballot for someone they think has the right values. Evers says Wisconsin voters appreciate, and will come to appreciate as he meets more of them, that he's an authentic candidate. He's open and true to who he is. He's not going to change just because he's running for governor, even if some people might want him to. Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio.